Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Senate voted last night on 4 gun control proposals, and the vote went exactly the way pretty much everyone expected it to. All 4 proposals failed. Of course, that isn't anything new. Even before last night's vote, though, the National Rifle Association doubled down on its opposition to any new gun control laws. Here's NRA CEO Wayne LaPierre on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday.
Laws didn't stop them in San Bernardino, where you had every type of gun control law you could have. And they didn't stop them in Paris, where people can't even own guns.
However, a UMass Boston researcher sifted through 50 years of data on mass shootings and came to a different conclusion. He says some very specific laws do work. Moreover, his research gives us critically important new context and insight into why shootings are getting deadlier and more frequent in this country. Luis Clarivas is a professor of global affairs at UMass Boston. He teaches homeland security and counterterrorism there, and his forthcoming book is Rampage Nation: Securing America from Mass Shootings. He joins us today from NPR in New York. Professor Clarivas, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be here with you.
So, first of all, tell me why it is that you decided to go back 50 years and collect all this data on mass shootings. What did you hope that it could illuminate for you?
Yeah, one of the weaknesses, if you will, in our field of research when it comes to looking at mass shootings is that we tend to look at kind of the short game. We look at what's happened in the last 5 years, the last 10 years. There have been a few studies that go back to about maybe the mid-1980s. And I wanted to do 2 things. One, I wanted to go back to at least 50 years. And I began with 1966, which coincidentally is when the University of Texas sniper incident occurred, which a lot of people consider the first modern day mass shooting, and go from 1966 and bring it forward to the end of 2015, which gave me 5 decades worth of data. That was one thing. The other thing I wanted to do was kind of expand the definition of, well, there's a debate over what constitutes a mass shooting.
Right.
I kind of went with the more liberal definition, if you will, the kind of more broader definition, which looked at all kinds of shootings, not just those that occurred, say, in churches or in shopping malls, in very public open spaces.
So that you included homes and things like that.
Correct.
Yeah. And I see
that homes and businesses.
So we're specific here. The definition that you used in terms of the number of people that had to be killed in order to qualify for a mass shooting, again, for your research was 6 or more people. And that led you to saying that, 111 shootings fit that definition in a 50-year period?
Correct. I defined it as a gun massacre. And okay. The gun massacre was a category of mass shooting which involved 6 or more people being murdered in a single incident.
Okay. So in the book, then, you analyze several components of these mass shootings or massacres. You looked at the shooters, the targets, and the weapons they used. And you've discovered some common threads throughout this 50 years of violence. So let's talk about some of them, starting with the perpetrators. What did you find about who mass shooters tend to be?
Well, let me begin with the finding, which won't surprise, I believe, anybody, which is that in all but one case, in all but one of the 111 – well, actually, it's 108 cases in this instance because we don't know who the perpetrator was in 3 of them.
Mm-hmm.
But in all but 100 – in all but one of the 108 cases, the perpetrator was a male. They tend to be males in the age range of 16 to 59. There were no senior citizens, for example, and no one under 16 who committed a gun massacre in the past 50 years. And the other finding, and this one's controversial, is that in 102 of the 108 instances, I found that there were indications or evidence that at least one of the perpetrators of those shootings had a psychiatric disorder, which would be covered under what's called DSM-5, which is the kind of Bible, if you will, for the for psychiatrists in terms of diagnosing people with disorders.
Uh-huh.
So it basically, kind of just to put that in another context, you find evidence in these cases of basically mental illness or mental instability.
In many of the cases that you looked at. Okay.
Correct. In the vast majority.
Now, what about the targets of the attacks? Because there are some people out there who say that mass shooters tend to look for quote-unquote soft targets or places where people are less likely to be armed in order to defend themselves. And in fact, in this era of our deep concerns about terrorism, those worries about soft targets are, you know, heightened further still.
Yeah, correct. And it's also become part of the political campaign, if you will, where you have on one side of the campaign, Hillary Clinton calling for, you know, more gun restrictions. And on the other side, you have the Republican, the presumed nominee, Donald Trump, making comments along the lines of, if, you know, more people were armed in these situations, they would be able to stop the shooter kind of mid-rampage. So one of the things that I looked at is this is the concept known as gun-free zones. And one of the arguments is that gun-free zones tend to be a magnet for mass shootings, that perpetrators purposefully select places that will where they know no one will be armed. So what I did was I went back and I looked at the 111 cases, and what I found was that 13 occurred in what are truly gun-free zones. And by truly gun-free zone, I mean it's somewhere where no one was armed and where civilians are prohibited from carrying arms. Another 5 occurred in what I called gun-restricting zones. A good example of a gun-restricting zone would be Virginia Tech. Mm-hmm. We had a massacre in Virginia Tech in 2007. It was until recently the deadliest mass shooting in the United States. And Virginia Tech is a campus where, you know, students couldn't have guns, but there was an armed police force on campus. So a gun-restricting zone is a place where there are people who are armed who are regularly on patrol, but they're not civilians. They're either armed guards or police officers. And then the last category was gun-allowing zones. And what I found was that 13 were in gun-free zones, another 5 in gun-restricting zones, and the other 93 massacres occurred in places where civilians are not prohibited from being armed.
Okay. So it seems like you're implying that the purported presence of armed civilians doesn't make any difference in terms of the targets that shooters choose.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. They don't – in fact, I'll go further. They don't – there's no evidence that they are selecting or pre-selecting targets where people will not be armed.
Okay. So I do want to talk with you in a minute or two about sort of the implications of all your research, but there's one more sort of part of the data set that I want to explore as well in order to set the context here. And that is, of course, one of the things that so many people are focused on now, and that's the actual type of weapon used. There's a lot of focus on semi-automatic rifles, military-style rifles, right now, because they were used in Orlando and San Bernardino in Newtown and in Aurora. But there seems to be evidence that that's definitely not the majority of the weapons used in these mass shootings.
Right. So one of the things that, you know, when you have a data set that's 111 cases, it gives you kind of a really good, robust picture of what's happening and what's happened in the past 50 years. So of those, just to kind of put it in context, of those 111 incidents, 28 involved what we call assault weapons or assault rifles. Let's call them assault weapons because some of them are kind of handgun assault weapons and not technically assault rifles. So 28 involved assault weapons, which means it's about a quarter. So 3/4 don't involve assault weapons. If I could go a step further, the one thing that I wanted to kind of take a look at was, let's break this down in terms of some of the more prominent mass shootings. I looked at the 15 deadliest mass shootings, and what I found was that in 8 of them, they involved assault weapons. But those same 8 also involved extended capacity magazines.
Uh-huh.
But when I went a little bit further and I looked at all 15 cases, what I found was that 13 of the 15 deadliest mass shootings involved extended capacity, or what sometimes are referred to as high capacity or large capacity magazines. These are magazines that, depending on which state you're in, by law, hold either more than 10 or more than 15 bullets. Hmm. And when you start to look at those numbers, you see a different picture. When you look at the cases that involved extended capacity magazines, I found that about half of the cases involved extended capacity magazines, and they accounted for about maybe close to like 55-60% of all the deaths, that of the cumulative deaths across the massacres from the past 50 years.
Okay. Well, I'm speaking with Luis Clarivas. He teaches security and counterterrorism at UMass Boston. His forthcoming book is Rampage Nation, Securing America from Mass Shootings. It will be published in August, but he's speaking to us about it now. Professor Clarivas, I mean, so you just basically you said that it seems as if instead of, let me put it this way, I'm searching for implications for your research, and it seems to be that one of them is maybe we should focus less on the actual weapons in terms of prevention and more on components of the weaponry. I mean, so is one of the implications that perhaps more laws at the state or federal level on those high-capacity magazines, if we pass laws restricting those, that that might have an effect on the lethality, the increasing lethality of these mass shootings?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That seems to be the precise implication based on this research, that if you want a way forward, you know, if you're looking for practical policy prescriptions, you know, something that we can do in Washington or something that we can do at the state level, something for legislators to keep in mind is, you know, maybe instead of regulating entire classes of weapons like assault weapons, maybe the more practical aspect here and perhaps the one that will save a lot more lives would be if we can regulate the component, in this case, the large capacity magazines.
Hmm. Well, so speaking of you know, previous legal attempts or attempts to use the law in order to curb this form of violence, I mean, lots of people say that the assault weapons ban worked, which was, of course, sunsetted in 2004. And other people say it didn't work because it didn't make a measurable difference in the overall reduction of violence or violent acts in this country. And where, given the 50 years of research that you looked at or 50 years of data that you looked at, where do you come down on the assault weapons ban?
Well, first, those people who say that are right. The people who say that it didn't really have a dramatic impact on violent crime, it didn't. And that's for a very simple reason. A lot of violent crimes aren't perpetrated with assault weapons. For example, armed robberies, muggings, these aren't the things, you know, somebody doesn't walk down the street with an AR-15 and come up to you and say, hey, you know, pull out the AR-15 and say, I'd like to have your iPhone.
Right. It's handguns.
Just turn it over.
Yeah.
You're right. It's usually handguns. However, if you draw a distinction between general gun violence and mass shootings, you'll find a different implication. What I was able to discern was that over – and what I did was I looked at a three-decade period. I looked at the decade immediately preceding the assault weapons ban and the decade of the assault weapons ban and then the decade immediately following the assault weapons ban. And for the listeners, the assault weapons ban was in effect from September of 1994 through 2004, and it had a sunset provision, which means that if Congress didn't kind of re-up it in 2004, it would expire on its own, and that's exactly what happened. And what I was able to see from the data was that in the decade immediately prior to the ban going into effect, there were 19 gun massacres, and those 19 gun massacres accounted for 155 deaths total. The decade of the assault weapons ban, the number of massacres fell by about a third to 12, and the number of deaths also fell significantly to 89.
Hmm.
What really stands out is what happens after the bill sunsets, after the bill expires, after the ban expires. We have over a 10-year period, a jump from 12 massacres in one decade to 34 massacres in the following decade. And the number of deaths more than triples from 89 to 302. And just to kind of speak to the, if you will, the importance of this ban and its significance in terms of having a policy impact. During the years, it's a five-year period, 1994 through 1998. 94, 5, 6, 7, 8. That five-year period, there is not a single gun massacre that occurs in the United States. Now, just to be kind of put it in context, that doesn't mean there wasn't a mass shooting. It just means that of the deadliest mass shootings, those that involved more than five deaths, there were none for a five-year period. That has never happened before since 1966 when I started tracking the data, and it hasn't happened since. And in the past decade, we haven't had one single year without a gun massacre.
So, you know, it's interesting because we were looking at, you know, a particular report following the end of the assault weapons ban. And this was a research study that came out in 2004 led by Christopher Coper, I believe that's how you say his name, which was an updated assessment on the federal assault weapons ban. And it's funny because that 2004 report is used by both sides of the gun control debate on whether or not the assault weapons ban worked. And later on, several years later, Coper himself, who was at George Mason University said that that eliminating or greatly reducing crimes with these high-capacity magazines could produce a small reduction in shootings, something less than 5%. This is from a talk that he gave in early 2013. But then he says, we should note that the effects of this magnitude could be hard to ever measure in any very definitive way, but they are nonetheless, they could have non-trivial, notable benefits for society. And here's why he said that. He says, consider, for example, at our current level of gun violence, this is all gun violence overall, not just the mass shootings or massacres that you were focused on. He says, achieving a 1% reduction in fatal and non-fatal criminal shootings could prevent approximately 650 shootings annually. A 1% reduction reduces drops 650 shootings annually. I mean, that, I guess that just speaks to the overall spectacular volume of gun violence we see in this country, and that it seems as if he's saying the laws do help.
Yes, and he's also written something subsequent to that where he's argued that the place you're most likely to see a benefit would be in the area of mass shootings. Again, he doesn't have specific data on this. He's just kind of extrapolating from the general overall gun violence picture. But you're right in terms of raising the point of, like, the magnitude of gun violence in this country is astronomical. I like to tell students sometimes, just to kind of put it in perspective, we are obviously deeply troubled by an event like 9/11. But if you look at gun violence since 9/11, we've had at least 10 9/11s in terms of fatalities, probably more, as a result of just gun violence.
Well, Louis Clarivas, let me ask you then. I mean, so specifically, we talked about high-capacity magazines, and it seems as if you're advocating laws that would reduce the accessibility of those. Are there any other specific policy proposals that you think would be effective in addition, given your research?
Well, I think that would be the most important one. And there's a kind of corollary to that, which is that it's not enough just to ban magazines, but maybe we should think about doing what some other countries have done, well, in particular what Australia has done, which is to have a buyback program. And I kind of try to make this point that it's one thing to regulate a class of weapons. It's another thing to regulate a component of weapons. It's a lot easier. It's a lot more practical. If you were to require that people take their magazines and have them kind of modified or retrofitted so that there's a cap of 10 bullets. And it could be done. It's not impractical. You don't have to make people turn in their magazines. They can be retrofitted. It's maybe something even that the government can fund. Or in the alternative, the government can buy back magazines. That would be one practical solution. To go a little bit further beyond that, there's some other ideas that I have in the book which I discuss, which are related to who gets to buy guns, kind of who's on the prohibited category list. Right now, there's a list that dates back to 1968. It's some of the common categories of people who are prohibited would be people who are adjudicated as mentally defective, and that's the legal term. That's not my term. Or people who are convicted felons, people who have been dishonorably discharged, illegal immigrants. If you were to go a little bit further and expand that, one of the things that I think would be really important, especially since you see that a lot of these shootings tend to have a domestic angle, even some of the shootings that you don't tend to think of as having a domestic angle do, like, for example, Newtown, which began at home with Adam Lanza killing his mother. If you were to basically expand the category and have it be so that people who have committed in the past misdemeanor violent acts, if people who have convicted who have committed misdemeanor violent acts were prohibited from owning a gun, whether it be forever or even at least for a 5 or 10 year period, that could make a significant impact.
That seems like a huge mountain to climb, though, given that just last night the Senate couldn't even pass proposals expanding, keeping people who are on the no-fly list from buying weapons.
Right. my only rebuttal to that comment is my job is to provide the data, and the people in Washington can decide what to do with it. I can't. I, I'm not an elected official. I don't get to vote on these things. I can give them my advice. I can give them my recommendations, and they can go from there.
Well, Professor,
but you're right.
I'm running out of time here, but I do have just one last quick question for you, because there's something very sobering. Your whole book is very sobering, but there's a particular sentence that you said. I just want to read it and get your further thoughts on it, because you say America is a rampage nation where mass shootings now pose the greatest single threat to public safety, surpassing even terrorism. But is it possible that terrorism is exactly the thing that may focus policymakers' minds on reducing gun violence in America, unlike anything we've had before?
No doubt about it. We have, for whatever reason, as a society, we react to terrorism. We are, I don't know if the right word is frightened, but we are certainly concerned about terrorism. Mass shootings are, you know, nothing new. They've been going on, like as I document in the book, for 50 years. They've been increasing in lethality. They've been increasing in frequency, but they're not new. But terrorism in the last, since 9/11, terrorism has kind of really taken on a whole other level, and people do react to that. And if terrorists use guns, as we saw in San Bernardino, in Fort Hood, and in Orlando, it's the kind of thing that will bring attention to both mass shootings and the overall gun violence problem.
Well, Luis Clarivas teaches security and counterterrorism at UMass Boston. His forthcoming book out in August is Rampage Nation, Securing America from Mass Shootings. Professor Clarivas, thank you so much for your book, and thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.